Right About Now.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to Right About Now. It's Jonathan Small, your host. I know you have a choice in podcasts, and I thank you for choosing mine. Okay, such a good show today. We've got New Yorker cartoonist Emily Flake, who's going to talk to us about her new book, That Was Awkward, The Art and Etiquette of the Awkward Hug.
God, so I was at my sister's house for like Thanksgiving or Christmas, and you know, I was in the kitchen doing something, and I dropped something, and I bent down to pick it up, and then like my dad all of a sudden was behind me, and mind you, in his boxers, and he kind of like chose that moment to hug me, but he kind of draped himself over my back, and I was not expecting this, and it was very weird, and I kind of like squirmed out from under him, and I turned around, and I was just like, never ever fucking do that again.
How great is that? The awkward hug. Why did I not think of this idea? Well, she has totally executed a brilliant idea really well. I was so excited to talk to a New Yorker cartoonist. I have been reading the New Yorker cartoons since I was a little kid. Even when I didn't understand them, I would read them. I was obsessed with them. And then as I got older, I started to appreciate not only the cartoons, but also the amazing writing in the New Yorker. And Emily does both. She does cartoons, the sort of short single panel cartoons. She also does what they call long form cartoons. And she does the shouts and murmurs section as well. So she is a woman of many talents. In addition to that, Emily is a stand-up comic. She had a weekly strip called Lulu 8-Ball, which ran in alt weeklies for many, many years. Emily has written and illustrated two other books, These Things Ain't Gonna Smoke Themselves and Mama Tried. And you can see her illustrations and cartoons appear in all sorts of publications aside from The New Yorker, including The New York Times, Newsweek, The Globe and Mail, and The Onion. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and her daughter and what she calls her frail, elderly orange cat. So sad. It needs a hug. No, it needs an awkward hug. All right, we're going to get to my conversation with Emily, who was a blast to talk to. But first, I want to share some information with you. I am very reachable. A lot of people think I'm just an empty voice in your ears or on your car stereo, but I'm actually a real person who can be reached and talked to, and it's kind of lonely doing a podcast because you put it out there and you don't really hear back from anybody except for the rare friend who might chime in on Facebook. Hello, Helen Dewey. But I love feedback. So if you have feedback, positive or negative, let me tell you the many ways to get in touch with me. First of all, I'm on email. So you can write me at Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, at rightaboutnowmedia.com. I am also on Facebook, although these days with Facebook, I'm not so thrilled about our friends at Facebook, but I'm still there, and I seem to have the most active community on Facebook. So it's Facebook.com/rightaboutnowpodcast. You can find me on Twitter at Kid Finesse, and I am also at Instagram at Right About Now Podcast. These are the many ways to reach out and say hello. I also have a newsletter that I send out once a week, which includes tips and tricks about the writing trade, some recommendations about what I'm reading or what I'm watching or what I'm listening to. So there's a whole plethora of things. All you have to do is reach out and say hello, and I'll get you hooked up. Free of charge. All right, so here we go with my interview with the one and only Emily Flake. Welcome to Right About Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I love your book. I love your cartoons. I have never had a New Yorker cartoonist on the show, so I have a million questions for you. I hope you'll indulge me just for a moment.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, growing up, there was a family friend who was a New Yorker cartoonist, who I guess my dad knew from like college or something. His name is Arnie Levin. And it was always like this mystique about Arnie Levin was like this New Yorker cartoonist, and we knew him, and we had like an original Arnie Levin in, you know, our living room, and I used to just like stare at his comics and try to like dissect why they were funny, and I've just been an obsessed New Yorker reader since I was a kid reading the cartoons, and then later as an adult reading the articles, but still reading the cartoons. But tell me, I'd love to hear a little bit about this, your journey from an early cartoonist to where you are now. And when did you first sort of discover that you had this gift and ability to draw and make people laugh?
So I went to school for illustration, but I drew my whole life and I always wrote. I actually not too long ago found an essay I had written when I was 9 saying that my goal was to be a comedienne, which I then parentheses like that's feminine for comedian. and that I wanted and that I might write some books someday. So, you know, this whole idea of being somebody who like made things, whether I drew them or wrote them or performed them, was kind of clearly in place like from an early age. And I wish I had a picture to show you. This picture I have of myself at this age where I'm the most impossibly dorky human being you have ever seen in your life. And it's clear that the only way forward for this person is to figure out how to be funny. So
was it the way you dressed and your hair? Like, what was it?
Oh, all of it. So I was 9 in 1985. I don't know if you remember the horrible things people were doing to children's hair in 1985.
Just dreadful.
But basically, yeah. Oof. And I had like thick bottle, you know, Coke bottle glasses. I looked like a tiny secretary. It was a bad scene.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up 2 towns outside of Hartford, Connecticut, a place called Manchester.
Okay. I went to school at Connecticut College in New London, so I know Connecticut.
Okay.
Okay, so you grew up with these, you're a tiny secretary. Was this by your own design, or was this a mean trick that your parents played on you?
Oh, God, no. I had not a whole lot of agency over my hair in a weird way. I remember, like, I grew it out long enough for the woman who babysat me to put pigtails in it, and I was super excited because I was going to get, like, pink yarn pigtails, and then my parents took me for a haircut, and I emerged with this monstrosity, and I didn't have hair long enough to make pigtails again for, like, a super long time. So, yeah, I think this was just, I mean, I feel like they were decisions made more of haplessness than malice on my parents' part, but, you know, the result is the same.
So when you growing up, were your parents, you know, writers? Was it just a pipe dream that you, this idea that you wanted to be a comedian?
Oh, it was a total pipe dream. Yeah. My dad was an actuary and my mom had sort of like, you know, various, she held jobs here and there, but she didn't have like a career per se. So yeah, there was nothing necessarily like in my immediate upbringing that would have like suggested this as a career path. But my grandfather on my father's side was, a sign painter and a muralist and a cartoonist who had a strip in the newsletter of the shipyard that he worked at during World War II.
Oh, wow.
So there was a family precedent, but it, like, I didn't grow up anywhere near my grandparents. So I think it was like more genetic than like, you know, the culture of my family.
Right. So, okay. So you have this, were you drawing right away? Because you wanted to be a comedian. Did you always have a gift for art?
I always drew, I never really like had a preference one way or the other. Like I knew I liked writing and I knew I liked drawing. When I went to school for art, in some ways I did it because I didn't want to ever hate writing. And I felt like, you know, if I make this the focus, if I make writing the focus, I might come to hate it. And I wanted to keep it sort of, you know, more for myself, I guess, in a way. So, you know, I decided to go for illustration instead. And, you know, and it's funny because there are times when I'm like, oh, no, I absolutely hate the way I draw and I hate drawing. So I guess I knew what I was in for.
You still hate the way you draw?
God, I have a lot of emotional baggage concerning like the way I draw.
I love the way you draw.
Oh, thank you. That honestly makes me feel really good to hear.
I think it's wonderful. So you were, yeah, but I mean, that's classic of, you know, talented people and writers and, you know, that you can't look at your own work, right? I mean, it's just,
yeah.
So you did this, I guess, all through high school. Then you went to college. Mm-hmm. When you made this decision, was that in undergrad to go to become an illustrator?
Yeah. I went to the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore and throughout high school, you know, I would like draw and write, and I had a fanzine because I was, you know, I was a punk rock kid, and that's what you did if you didn't play an instrument. And then my focus in college was just like straight up editorial illustration.
Okay, so like appearing in magazines and newspapers and that kind of thing?
Exactly. And then I took this painting class from a man named Ken Tisa, who was one of my very favorite instructors. And I started doing these, like, what I just called, like, they're just kind of like funny little paintings. Like, I would try to make basically like painting cartoons. And he was like, these are great. You should keep doing these. And I took that to heart.
And then were people buying those?
No, I mean, when I say like, you know, basically I just got like good feedback from teachers.
Right.
But it made me realize that like using humor was a way that I could sort of deflect from my deficiencies as a visual artist. And that was very useful information for me to have.
So when did you start putting words to the art?
Kind of always. I think like in one way or another, I did that my whole life. And then, you know, these little paintings that I started doing in college were the first time I sort of thought like, you know, maybe this really is something I could integrate into, you know, who I am as a thing maker.
And what was your first job out of college?
So I had day jobs, you know, of one kind or another until I was almost 30. But my first like actual illustration gig, I started going up from Baltimore to New York to show my portfolio around when I was still in college. And then like right when I graduated, I got an assignment from Juxtapose magazine. Pop Smear.
Uh-huh.
They paid in postcards, which was actually very useful because you needed postcards. And it was an article about teen girl serial killers. And so that was like it was like a full page illustration in like three spots. And that was like my first gig. And at the time,
hilarious.
I was like, this is it, man.
Yeah, hilarious, too. Hilarious subject matter.
Exactly. Like, but, and I fully thought that, like, having one gig meant, like, from now on, it's just going to be gravy. And it was not.
You're going to be like, I'm going to be awash in postcards. Yeah.
Uh-huh, exactly.
So, but it was not. So it went well. It must have been amazing to see yourself in print.
Oh, it was great.
But it wasn't like the calls came, like, hundreds of calls came after that.
Oh, God, no, not at all. You know, I spent the next 4 years in Chicago just, you know, basically just like working and drinking. and I would get illustration gigs here and there, but it was never anything close enough to live off of. So that didn't really happen for me until I kind of sucked it up and moved to New York.
Really? So you made a decision, I'm going to really go for it?
Mm-hmm. So I was 26 when I moved to New York, and at that point I was just like, you know, I'm just kind of spinning my wheels here. If I don't get out, and I didn't have any intention of spending like the rest of my life in Chicago. And at 26, I was like, the rest of my life isn't some abstract thing. I am currently in the middle of living the rest of my life. If I don't get out of here,
right,
someday I'm going to die here. So I packed up my ancient failing Ford Escort. and I moved to Brooklyn and lived in a house with three even younger than me, like very even dirtier than me, punk rock kids. And you know, just worked. I worked at a gay alternative newsweekly selling ad space, which I was terrible at. And then I got a job at a record distributor, Caroline. And I had worked in record distribution when I was in Chicago too. So that job I was actually like not as terrible at. And when I'd been here for a year or so, I started socking away all my day job money and trying to just live off of what I made off of illustration and cartooning. And then after about 6 months of that, I had enough saved that I felt like if I quit, you know, I'm not fucked. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I swear on that?
Yeah. Please.
Okay.
Please.
You know, I won't be completely out of luck, you know, for at least a few months. So that is what I did.
And then what was your sort of big break? Or did it happen in little breaks?
It was a lot of little breaks, although getting into the New Yorker definitely, I think, kind of was a step towards legitimizing me in a way. Like it was for sure the most high profile thing that my comics work had ever been in. I had a strip that ran in alt weeklies for about north of a decade, called Lulu 8-Ball, which I very much loved doing. I stopped doing it in 2016. I still kind of miss it, but it's also there are no alt weeklies left. So,
yeah.
And then I started submitting to the New Yorker in 2008 and, you know, submitted for, I think, like 7 or 8 months before I got something in. But that, you know, having something in that magazine, I think really went a very long way towards, towards opening up their doors for me.
Do you remember what that cartoon was that got into the New Yorker?
Yeah. It was a teenager looking sort of sad on a, you know, shamed on a sofa and her father saying, "I'm not disappointed. I'm just very, very mad."
I love that.
Thanks.
It's a juxtaposition. That is good.
Yeah, exactly.
That works.
Just flip the script on some stuff and there you got a cartoon.
Well, that kind of, I mean, I know this is probably, I hate when people ask me, where do your ideas come from? But I'm going to ask
right.
you. So, you know, when you do, I mean, how does that, what is your process for coming up with ideas for cartoons? I mean, do you have like a notepad and something, you see something that kind of might be funny and you jot it down? Or what is your process? You just...
I have a clipboard that I actually stole from my last day job that
I won't tell anybody.
Paper on. Yeah. I owe them 89 cents. So I kind of keep that in lieu of a sketchbook. It's sort of my lucky clipboard. So I write things down that as they occur to me, and I have like a running note on my phone. And a lot of times I'll sit down and try to write, and I'll just kind of like write down random words and start free associating off of them, which can be, you know, certainly helpful. But a lot of times, like, you know, I'll sit down and try to come up with ideas, and I'll sit there for an hour and I've just got nothing. But then, you know, I go away and perform some task and something will occur to me that has nothing even to do with what I was working on, but I feel like it wouldn't have come to me if I hadn't sat there and like put up the bat signal to whatever muse there is that like I needed some ideas. So it's almost like a religious ritual, you know, you like do this in hopes of satisfying some god, and then maybe the god will smile on you.
So sometimes it's really like a process of just staring at your sketch pad, and other times it's just you're walking around and it'll hit you like, oh my god, that's funny.
Yeah, exactly. And if I don't write it down like right away, it is always lost. Like I always feel like, oh, this is so good, I'm definitely going to remember it, and I never, ever, ever do.
That is so true. I have the exact same. I hate that, and I'm always like, what was that idea I had? I love so much, and I get so mad at myself.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, this was the $1 million one.
This was the one. Do you think in terms of the words, or do you think of the illustration first?
Oh, 100% words first.
Okay. So you consider yourself more of a words person, or, I mean, that's just your process. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So now are you a staff cartoonist for the New Yorker, or are you just a regular contributor for the New Yorker?
So I'm on contract, which means that they have first right of, like, you know, they get first pass on anything that I produce. And, you know, people use that to mean, people use the descriptor staff writer to like, to say that, but we're not really on staff, you know, like I don't draw a salary from them and I don't get benefits or anything like that.
Right.
So it's sort of like a freelancer plus.
Right. They get first right, and they probably pay a little bit better than a lot of the other clients, I would imagine.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's not like I wasn't going to show them first anyway.
So that's like, I mean, it's true with writing for them too. Like they pay a lot more than the industry normal.
No, for sure.
Tell me about that, because I have heard a little bit about that process, but I'd love you to explain it, of like how you submit and how that all works with the New Yorker.
Sure. So there is a submission day. It's Tuesdays, and you can go in and like and have a meeting. The current editor, Emma, you know, keeps office hours, and you can go in that day and show her your batch in person. And if she is not going to be in the office that day, her assistant will often send out a blanket email to like everybody who has ever, you know, sent anything in, just saying like no office hours this week. But I think that process, because that's exactly what I did when, you know, 10 years ago when Bob Mankoff was the editor, I went in and, you know, showed him my stuff in person every week. And I think that's very helpful in terms of an editor getting an idea of just like who you are as a person, and if you're somebody who they want to work with, et cetera, et cetera. Now I just email my batch in as a PDF. for the most part because I don't want to have to put on pants. So
pants are such a drag. Yeah.
Oh, the worst. Yeah. The worst. Anything I can do to stay in PJs is yeah.
Well, that's a great case. So well, when you were going in, even in the Bob Mankoff days, I mean, how does it work? Do you just sort of like, it's different than like sitting and pitching a story or something. Do you have the illustration and he reads it and he's either is going to be like, or he's going to be like, what else you got?
Exactly. It's just like trial by fire thing where you sit across from like the person who could make or break you and just watch them look at your stuff.
That's hard.
Yeah. It's like, you know, and because I'm chatty generally, like my instinct is always to be like, and so this is, and I'm like, just shut up. Let's just let him look at your work.
And does he sort of make the decision right there? Or is he like, or Emma, or do they say like, we'll get back to you. Like, this is a good one.
So they'll take something to hold to consider, like right then and there. And then the meeting is the next day and they go through the pile of maybes and they select like, you know, 17 or 15 or whatever they're buying that week.
So you're obviously able to make a living and a good living doing what you do. Who else are your clients? Like, how does one, like, can you just be a New Yorker cartoonist and survive? Or do you have other, I mean, obviously you have this book, which we are going to talk about, I promise. But I'm curious just how it works for a cartoonist financially.
So, yeah, you can't really just cartoon for the New Yorker and nobody else. Because, like, I don't think anybody has enough of a hit rate to live off of unless you live somewhere, like, super cheap and you're very frugal.
Yeah.
And I don't, and I am not. So for one thing, I feel like I have different segments of the New Yorker that I work for. So, you know, I do the cartoons and then I sell some of them Shouts and Murmurs at times. And I do longer form cartoons for them. So I try to like use that resource as much as possible. But I also, I also still do, you know, freelance editorial illustration. There are a few other outlets. TheNib.com is a place where I do a lot of cartoons for them, and they are fantastic. Like, they just recently moved into a subscription model, and they are just one of the few sort of like great independent cartooning voices for cartoonists out there. So,
and then other stuff you do. I know you do stand up.
I do. I don't like, you know, I hesitate to call myself an actual stand-up because it's something that I do because I love it. And I find that it is very useful to me in terms of sort of making myself alive to that muse. But, you know, I'm not out there like grinding out mics every night or anything like that because I'm old and I have a child. And I don't have any illusions about like, you know, making it as a stand-up. I just love to do it. And I generally speaking do this sort of hybrid thing where like I show cartoons and then do bits and then show cartoons and do bits. And if showing cartoons isn't an option, then I'll just do the bits.
Yeah. And you can see your routines on YouTube. I watch and they're funny.
Oh, yay. Thank you.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you like stand-up because I think it sounds terrifying and a lot of writers can't even imagine wanting to get up there. What do you like about it?
It is immediate and electrifying, you know, like it's funny because like every time I've had like a bad cold or something and had to perform in any way, it's kind of like the minute I get up there, I feel great. And then the minute I get off stage, I feel terrible again. But it's like something about the adrenaline really like, I feel like helps wake up the part of my brain that writes. And so I find it like both enjoyable and kind of necessary. I'm always nervous, but never, I don't dread it.
Yeah. But it's interesting that you say like, cause I know the experience doing improv briefly where it's like, the moment up to it, I absolutely hate. And then you know, while it's happening, it's okay. Especially if there's some laughs. And then afterwards, all I do is just second guess and doubt everything I did. And why did I say that? And oh my God, I should have said this.
Yeah.
It's like, why do we do this? But you're true. There's nothing like putting yourself in that situation to spark that whatever that creativity, wherever it comes from.
Totally. And, you know, and then if it goes well, it's great. And if it goes badly, then it's like something bad happened and you didn't die. You know?
Yeah.
So either way, it's instructive and useful.
I guess that's my fear of stand-up is bombing. But I don't know. I think even stand-ups who have been around, you know, are veterans, still nobody likes to bomb. But there's just...
No.
It's just the worst.
Yeah.
But if you can get over it, get through life not fearing bombing, then you probably are in a good place.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think that like anything is that you can do in your artistic practice that sort of forces you to kind of leap into the unknown is useful. And like, and bombing, like I bombed at like open mics, you know, and I'm just at where I'm just like, and I have 3 minutes, you know, and it's just like, this is the worst. But, you know, again, it's like, then it's over and you're not dead. So it's helpful. It's all helpful.
All right. Let's talk about your book. It reminded me of a not as good idea that I had when I first got out of college. I wrote this book and I had somebody else illustrate it called Things You Can't Look Cool Doing. And it was like, you know, things like, you know, carrying a cafeteria tray or, you know, waiting for a penny change in a store. But I love this idea of awkward hugs. That was awkward. The art of etiquette of the awkward hug. And it's interesting. You call it That Was Awkward. I wonder if there's going to be more. Could this be a series, or there could be more than awkward hugs coming down the road?
I mean, I don't want to brag, but I feel like I could explore a lot of awkward venues.
There's awkward things. I don't want to brag. Yes, I could share my entire life story with you. It's just one awkward moment.
Yeah. So I feel like there's a lot of room in the awkward space for exploration. And I feel like, you know, if there's one thing I'm an expert at, it's, you know, not knowing what to do with like my face or body at any given time. So, yeah, no, hopefully there are other like chambers to this to this house of horrors.
So why begin this house of horrors with hugs? Because it could have just been like a panel cartoon, right? Like, you know, here, like a Roz Chast style, you know, here are five, six awkward hugs, but you decide to make it into a whole book. So why did you kind of flesh out the idea like that?
So here is the crazy thing about how this book even happened. So there's an editor at Viking, Brian Tart, who like, you know, he had a book party for one of his authors. And then at the end of the night, he like went to hug this guy and it went terribly pear-shaped. I don't even know exactly what he did wrong, but it was one of those things where he just had this long, dark night of the soul, like, you know, cringing over what he had done. And, you know, being an editor, he was like, you know, maybe there's a book here. And apparently my personal awkward brand is so strong that when you think humiliating social experience, you think Emily Flake. So
get Emily on the phone. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. This sounds like a job. And so they called me in for a meeting and it went well. And they just kind of gave me the idea and were like, run with it. And that's kind of my favorite thing. If somebody's like, here is a premise, do something with this. Like, that's my favorite way to work. It's like the pressure's off me to come up with an idea.
Yeah,
but
the
I
best.
Can, it gives me something to use right away. So yeah, this is like a dream job.
It's a dream job, right? Like for you who like often just has to come up with cartoon ideas out of nothing, right? Like,
exactly. And pitch and pitch and pitch and get rejected, you know, whereas like to have somebody be like, here is a proposal that has already been thought. Like, now you write it. I was like, oh, shit. Yeah. Okay.
But I think what's interesting about it is that you kind of get into, certainly in the beginning, of like why hugs are important and why, you know, so it's not just like, okay, here's one funny hug. Here's another funny hug. Like, you actually kind of talk about them a little bit. But talk to me about hugs in general. Did you do a little research on the art of the hug?
Oh, and by research, I mean, I asked Wikipedia, but
and what did Wikipedia tell you?
Wikipedia told me, that hugs are, you know, they're like one of those sort of most elemental and important parts of human, affection and expression, you know, I mean, it's like a natural outcropping of like, you know, holding your progeny, you know, so that they don't get eaten. They are so universal and yet so fraught. You know, I mean, I feel like there's no instinctual thing that humans can't mess up. So it kind of follows that we would have made hugs weird.
Yes. And we have made them very, very weird. I had that horrible hug moment where it was like, are we on hugging terms yet? Kind of moment where I had met this person like twice. And one person sort of shook her hand goodbye. And then I was like, sort of my turn. I felt like we were sort of on hugging terms because we had talked a lot and she had emailed me and I kind of went in for the hug and it was like kind of a little bit of a flaccid hug. And it was like, oh God, maybe that was not. Yeah. So that was like an awkward hug where you don't know when it's the right time, like when you're actually on hugging terms.
Right. And it's so tough because we don't have like an accepted social code for this, you know, like there's nothing where you're like, okay, this is absolutely a hugging situation. So we just kind of have to flap and hope for the best.
And you have a few hugs in there that are so classic, like the non-returned hug. Like, I forgot what it's called. You told the story of somebody went in for a hug and you know, the other person, just their arms are like straight down. You know, you do that hug. Oh God, that hug is the worst.
Yeah. And it's like, how do you pull out of that skid? Like, you just kind of have to extricate yourself and feel bad.
Yes. You call it the, oh no, you didn't want that hug. Yeah. Right. And when you're in mid of that hug, you're just like, oh God, this is the worst moment.
Yeah.
I've got to get out of this. Time stops.
It just stretches on to infinity.
So when you came up with these hug ideas, did you just write a list of all the weird hugs that you've been involved in your life? And
pretty much. I mean, like they had a general outline.
Right. Cause you break it into relationships. It's like relationships and family and then work hugs. So yeah, they gave you that outline. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. And it makes sense too. Cause it's like, you know, you have a lot of different personae that you sort of adopt throughout the day. You have like the person that you are at work and the person you are with your family, et cetera, et cetera. So there's like a bunch of different angles for you to screw up in any given day. So it seemed like it made sense to kind of separate it into these categories.
Some of the hugs in here that definitely resonated with me. The used to bang in college hug, which is like which, you know, happens a lot in college reunions. I just went to one and we will not talk about that. But I mean, there's the, and the idea that you still smell that smell, you get in so close, the smell like triggers all these kind of things for you. You're like, oh my God, 30 years ago.
Right.
Yeah. That's an interesting one.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like there is a sadness to like these awkward social interactions because we all want we all want to be loved and we want closeness and, you know, like, and, you know, the sort of like, blubbering pile of needs that we all are on the inside. I feel like, you know, I kind of wanted to honor that through this book.
Right. Now it must be weird now when you hug people. I mean, once this book, you know, people are going to be like, was that awkward? Now you're just going
to... Oh God, I know. I had to sort of apologize at the start of, like, you know, we had a book launch on Monday and I read from it and I was like, look, I'm just going to tell you right now that, like, because we're talking about it, every hug you have tonight is going to be weird. So if it makes you feel better, just like as you're going for it, just say, God damn Emily Flake, you know, just blame it on me. Cause I feel like I made it even weirder by talking about it, but it's like, you know, it's like when you start talking about lice and people's heads start itching.
Yeah.
Like
you yawn and people start yawning. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you have this hug in here, the panic hug, and you tell us a funny story about a panic hug. What is a panic hug? Because I feel like everybody can identify with a panic hug.
So a panic hug is like when you just don't know what else to do and you're like, well, I guess I should hug you because you seem very upset. but yeah, that was an absolute true story. Like this was, you know, probably 25 years ago. I ran into the mother of a guy I had dated and we had broken up and like she was much more upset about it than I was. And I ran into her on my way to, I worked at a library and I ran into her like outside the library and she started crying and I was like, what do I do? So I hugged her, but you know, she's really little and like my hand kind of came to rest on the back of her head. And all I could think was like, she has like a little squirrel skull. It's the skull of a little squirrel. And I was trying so hard not to just break into hysterical laughter, which would have been like the cruelest thing I could have done. It was a whole thing.
That hug there's also just something very awkward about, you mentioned when your belly, I have a bit of a belly that has developed over the years. Mm-hmm. And there's always that.
Don't we all?
Isn't there that hug where, you know, a hugging by its very nature can be somewhat intimate. And so there's always that fear of like getting a little bit too close in the nether regions and kind of like you do that kind of hug where you sort of the butt out hug.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
And it becomes, I'm just much more aware of it now that I actually have a belly. So it's beyond even just the nether regions. It's that whole midsection. Mm-hmm. I don't want any contact with that section. It's
tremendously awkward.
I know. It's such a mess, you know. And then sometimes you can feel people really, like, you know, kind of over exaggerating the pulling the pelvis away thing, and yeah, you're like, wait, are you being weird?
It makes it weirder, almost.
Yeah, it's true. And in some ways, I feel like a belly kind of serves as like a handy barrier. But if you don't want that barrier there, then it's kind of a problem. But, you know, in some ways it's almost like it's a buffer.
Yes. The one hug that I don't, maybe it was in here, there was an iteration of it in here where the person, the long hugger, the person who just is just, it's a little bit too long.
Yeah. It's hard to, because I feel like everybody has like a mental countdown for when the hug should be over. But those countdowns don't always like line up. So, you know, I feel like if you're in one of those, I feel like the best you can do is sort of give that little like punctuation pat, like, thank you, and disengage, where it's like you're not. And I feel like the pat sort of like puts a nice button on it where you're like, this has been nice, thank you.
The pat.
So you're not just sort of like ripping yourself out of the
hug.
Yeah,
because sometimes you're just kind of like trying, you loosen and they don't loosen and you're like, oh, wow, I'm in it.
Yeah.
Although there is something, I think you mentioned it, and it might have just come from Wikipedia, and we can bring a doctor on later to verify this.
Uh-huh.
But that there are endorphins and things that are released when you're hugging. Like it's a happy, for the most part, even though it's pretty awkward, it's supposed to elicit happy brain chemistry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's positive touch, you know. So if we can sort of like, if you can get past the initial weirdness, it's really quite pleasant, I think. But I think that maybe because I'm a hugger and I am very physically affectionate, so I don't know, maybe not everybody wants my, you know, like Winnie the Pooh Tigger bounce. But if you're friends with me, that's what you get.
Are you a hugger? You're a big hugger.
I am a big hugger, but like I do confess in the book that like even though I'm a hugger, my main fear is that people will see how badly I want to be hugged. Like, you know, I'm just like this golden retriever of a woman being like, oh, please hug me. Please hug me.
Just want a hug.
Yeah. It's like that's, you know, nobody necessarily wants to be around the ball of need when it's that naked. So, you know.
And you mentioned you have a kid. I have two kids as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it changes as they get older. So like mine, and I have a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old. And so when the 10-year-old hugs me now, she's a little girl, you know, it's still like that incredible, like, oh my God, I love you so much.
Right.
But now when the 14-year-old hugs me, I love him, obviously, but it's a different, it's like coming from him, it's like a little bit of like a pat on the back. And, you know, now I smell, I can smell his underarms like very fragrantly because he's like a sweaty adolescent.
Oh, man.
How old is your kid?
So she's 7.
Okay. So you're still in that very cute hugging age.
Exactly. So is 10 still, cute?
10 is still super, super cute. They don't really get bad, I think, until they're 12. I don't know because I have a boy and a girl, and girls are so different. But yeah, I mean, my son likes to hug, but it's just not as like it used to be. And I just, you know, I still want to snuggle him. And
I know.
You have such a cute illustration in there of like a little, like of a man, like on top of his like of mom's lap.
Right.
But
I mean, that's something too. It's like, it's hard because I, you know, I kind of bristle often when my mother like goes to hug me or like touches me anyway. And I feel slightly bad about that now because I can't imagine a time when I won't have like unfettered access to my daughter's body, you know, because I grew her body in my body. And you know, you spend enough time like cleaning somebody's genitals and you feel like, you know, they just never stop feeling like an extension of you in a way. So to think that there's going to be a time where like I'm going to go to hug her and she'll like, you know, flinch or tell me to stop is just like horrifying.
That reminds me of that one story you told in the book, and I won't give too much of it away. This is the last thing, where the most awkward hug ever. And was it your dad or was it somebody's dad?
Yeah.
Oh, tell
yeah,
that. That was
my dad.
Hilarious. Tell that story.
God. So I was at my sister's house for like Thanksgiving or Christmas. And, you know, I was in the kitchen doing something and I dropped something and I bent down to pick it up. And then like my dad all of a sudden was behind me and mind you in his boxers and he kind of like chose that moment to hug me, but he kind of draped himself over my back. And I was not expecting this, and it was very weird. And I kind of like squirmed out from under him, and I turned around, and I was just like, never ever fucking do that again. And again, it's like, that was a harsher response than the action warranted. But it was just like that moment of rage brought out, like, it was like, you know, everything that I had ever been angry about in our family, like, came out of my mouth at that point. So yeah, it was definitely, like, I don't know if awkward is the word I'm looking for here.
It's more like just anger provoking and just obnoxious.
Exactly.
Inspiration for people who are listening to this podcast who want to get into the creative field, maybe even want to be a cartoonist, comedian. You know, it didn't happen right away for you, but you stuck it out. What do you think it was about you that made you stick it out? And what do you tell other people?
I think there really wasn't anything else I could do. I mean, the only other skills I really have is, like, I'm a good waitress and I am an excellent warehouse worker. But neither one of those seemed like really sustainable in the long run. So I guess just build a life where your safety net sucks and see what happens.
Did you have a plan B?
Did I have a plan B? Not really. You know, like, I didn't get a design degree. I didn't, you know, like, I kind of never learned how to, because I feel like a lot of people that I went to art school with ended up in the design world. I actually suck at graphic design and am almost completely illiterate in terms of, like, you know, InDesign or any of the programs, which is an embarrassing thing to admit. But I didn't have a backup plan that had anything to do with, you know, any of the fields that I wanted to go into. So yeah, I mean, like, my jobs that I had until I freelanced full time were pretty much non-professional jobs. So there were definitely, you know, years where I was just like, you know, I just don't know if this is ever going to happen, but I kind of just kept doing it because I didn't really have any other choice. And obviously, I feel like when I say, like, I had no choice, like that's a phrase that should really only be pulled out in, like, war times or time of actual, like, oppression, right. Which is not a thing I have I have access to. So,
well,
but yeah, just
you were riding the New York subway,
plodding along.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that came from Brooklyn to Manhattan, and yeah, that
exactly.
That's one of the reasons I left.
That has oppressive moments.
Yes, it has moments where you're like, why do I do this? Why do I subject myself to this? Like, do I really have to be in this situation every morning?
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And your advice that you give to people who want to get into cartooning, is it different than it was back in the day when you were getting into it? Are the rules somewhat the same, and is it the same kind of, has the internet changed everything, or?
I think it's a totally different landscape than when I was getting into it, for sure. I mean, there are a lot of people who, a lot of my colleagues at the New Yorker who, like, are younger and have been very successful on Instagram, which is obviously not a thing that existed when I was getting into cartooning. And I think it is a great way to build an audience and to develop your voice as a comics person. I feel like the most successful of those are people who are, like, very disciplined with their Instagram use, like Liana Fink, who is amazing. Like, all she posts is cartoons. You know what I mean? She doesn't use it as a personal thing. She doesn't use it to, like, you know, post a funny picture of a turkey she saw or anything like that. Like, it's all her cartoons. And I mean, and that has really worked out for her. So I think that somebody getting into it now, I feel like I would definitely exhort them to use social media in a way that wasn't available to me when I was younger. But that, and, you know, be present in whatever scene that it is you want to be in, you know, show up, go to things, say hi, like, let people know your name, try to be a pleasant person to be around so that people will want to be around you and want to introduce you to people that can help you. That's one of the things that really, like, struck me about moving to New York, is that, like, when I lived in Chicago, there was sort of a sense that, like, anything that was, like, you know, if you were like, oh, I should go to this party because somebody is going to be there who might help me do blah, 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 people would see that as kind of dirty, like networking was seen as dirty. Whereas here, I feel like everybody just understands that, like, we're all in the same boat and we're all trying to get along. So let's help each other if we can. And it's much cleaner and much more effective, I think.
Yeah, and I'm always surprised at people who don't learn this lesson early to never like burn a bridge and to just like be easy to work with. And like, I can't tell you the amount of bridges that are burned with me during the week. Not at the amount, but like not crazy. Right. But I'm surprised when I deal with, you know, freelance writers and stuff, because I'm editing now a lot of things, you know, like how difficult they can be. And like, I'll never work with you again. Why would you do this?
Yeah. Shocking. I mean, from a professional point and also just from a personal point, why would, like, you know, you don't like assholes, so don't be an asshole.
Right. It's a very good way to live your life. You don't like assholes, so why be one yourself? People get confused, though, between, you know, standing up for themselves and not being taken advantage of and then being an asshole. Like, there's like a kind of fine line, and I'm not always exactly sure how I would cross. And I'm probably a little bit too much of a pushover in my way. But I also feel like I just like dealing with people who are easy to work with and don't push back a lot.
Yeah, or it push back in ways that make sense and aren't, you know, like weird or defensive. And, you know, I mean, that can definitely be hard. I know as a freelancer, I have a really hard time saying no. And like, I have definitely been like, you know, something will happen. I'm like, oh, that's okay. but I think I will always want to err on the side of just like of being polite and as professional as I can be for somebody who works in pajamas.
And you've been incredibly professional and polite in this conversation, so I appreciate that. It's been so fun. It's been so fun talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a delight.
And good luck on the book. And is there anything else that people should know about in the Emily Flake universe that's coming out in the next month or so?
Ooh, if you are in New York or live in New York, I have a show every third Wednesday called Nightmares, where I and a co-host talk to a variety of people about their worst dreams. And then I give them a drawing based on that dream.
Oh, that is awesome. I want to go to that. Where is that?
Yeah,
is that in Brooklyn?
No, it's at the Red Room above KGB Bar in the East Village.
Well, that sounds really fun. That actually made me think, this is probably a stupid question, but the New Yorker captions, the caption contest. First of all, have you ever had one of your cartoons be a caption contestant?
Once. Yeah, I submitted something and they didn't buy the cartoon, but they said they would like to use, they were like, we want to buy it, but we want to put it in for the caption contest. So it was a bunch of people sitting around the guillotine that was like, you know, there as like a conversational piece. And I don't remember what my original caption was or what caption won, but that was the only time I've ever been in the caption contest.
Any advice for people doing those? Because I find those to be basically impossible. And it's probably because it's a
They are.
I mean.
And, you know, they get so many, like, you know, like, I guess just keep plugging away at it because, like, you know, they get, like, you know, thousands of submissions and there's always usually, like, variations on a theme. So I think it's rare that they get one like that's completely out of left field. But, you know, like write down a bunch of them and then like send in the one that seems like it came from the furthest left field, I guess. But yeah, it's a bear.
And no puns or plays on words.
Right. No puns.
Well, thank you so much. This wasn't too awkward, I hope. And have a
it's great.
Wonderful rest of your day. I'm going to go put on some clothes thanks.
For listening to Right About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, rightaboutnowmedia.com, and listen there. This is Ella, reminding you to do the right thing! Thank you.